Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa, coming to you from Radio Free Brooklyn, the best station in the Western Hemisphere. Go to our homepage at www.radiofreebrooklyn.com and donate money. Just a small amount. Just a tiny, tiny, tiny bit. Because we've all got to believe in free communication, free press, whatever you call it. So I'm here today. I am exhausted. I may not make any sense. Well, I'm trying to chill out. I just did this art fair spring break, and I did therapy on 100 people in 6 days. And maybe some of you might have even been there and are listening. And hello and welcome. I'm so glad you came to see me. It's possible you might be there. But that was a really, really intense experience. I got I actually got a lot better. I got it down. I got people in and out of there in like 5, 10, 15 minutes. My shrink was blown away yesterday when I told her, though, how many people I did. So my guest today is the highly talented David Humphrey. He's a really amazing painter. His work is so here's what's great about his work. I mean, there's so many things that are great about his work, but what I think is unusual is the combination of the painting, the narrative, the humor, the communication, but like all of that. And I had that opinion on my own, and then I read some of the reviews that other people who are really educated wrote and see a lot of painting. I don't even see that much painting. And they all agreed with me. So anyway, it's really interesting. I think it's very, very rare that you see a painter who is just operating at full tilt on so many levels at the same time. And that's what everybody said. And that's why he's got such a fucking great gallery, Fredericks and Frazier, which is like a really like blue chip gallery. Is it a blue chip gallery?
Maybe there's another hue. Maybe it's red chip or I don't know.
It's like a light blue chip gallery. It's not like a bullshit Gagosian thing.
Baby blue.
But it's a good gallery. How long have you been with them?
That was my third show.
So anyway, this is David Humphrey. And so we're going to talk to him about his work. And he just had a show that closed at Fredericks Fraser on February 25th. And we're going to find out what that was like for him, because he's like the consummate professional artist who's like been through it all and should be totally like, no big deal, but we'll find out. I don't know. He's making faces now. We'll see if I can get him to like crack on that. It's got to be stressful. But also, so this is really funny, and I was just telling David this. I kind of sprang it on him, ambushed him when he walked in. But so David and I met, well, we sort of had it. We had a friend in common during the 80s who was my next door neighbor, Mike Berg, when we lived in a loft building, me and my boyfriend David Cantor. We lived in a loft building across the street from where the Gansevoort Hotel is now. And like, I developed a big crush on David Humphrey. I was really dissatisfied in my own relationship, and I projected. I didn't know David Humphrey. I'm surprised he even remembered me, but he lived across the street from us. And he was really good friends with our next door neighbor. So I was sort of like, I was like, oh, there's that guy. We were both in, you know, relationships, but I had a thing for him. So I just told him that. So we may get into that. But I also want to, just out of respect, we are both happily married now. And he has an incredibly talented wife who I'm hoping to get to really meet in the near future. And she has a show up, and we want to make sure that you guys know about it. I saw an invite to the opening. Of course, I've been at Spring Break Hell, but and her show, Jennifer Coates, Coates, is at Freight and Volume, another great gallery. And where can you, just because we're on the topic, David, give us the address and tell us when it's open till.
It'll be up for a month.
Till when?
Till
April something.
Yes, April okay, something.
Okay, well, I'll post about it, too.
Somewhere in April, and it's on Allen Street, just below Delancey.
Okay, cool. So just so you know, like, this was, like, a whole other lifetime that I'm talking about as far as having a crush on David.
I wish you had
said something.
Note. You wish you had said something about them.
You might have thought I was cute.
Yeah, you could have saved a lot of trouble.
Yeah, right. Well, but then we wouldn't be doing this interview now. What's the point?
That's right.
So what I want David to do for us, our listeners, our people who are, like, at home or listening on, like, I always picture it's like a bunch of, like, either unemployed or underemployed creative people listening to this, but I want them to be buoyed by the discussion of your work. So, can you kind of articulate, how you would describe your work for us, and then also I want to talk a little bit about what the experience of having the show was like for you. So let's hear, how would you describe your work? How do you describe it?
Sure. It's hard to cook up from scratch, but it tends to be very hybrid. There's figures in them. There's gestures. There's elements of abstraction that kind of intrude onto narrative scenes. There's locations like workplaces or mud piles, there's guys lying on couches, there's people having conversations. So it's a pile-up that hopefully tells a story or tells many stories. One of them would include a conversation with spectators as to what they might imagine is there. The name of the show was called I'm Glad We Had This Conversation. And part of it had to do with what happens within the work. There's conversations going on there, but also they spin off.
So can you give me like a comment or some sort of, what kind of like comments make you feel like, oh, they got it when people, you know, are at the show or leave the show or comment on your show? When you see comments, what is it that you feel like, oh yeah, they got it? Can you say, is that?
Well, usually what pleases me is when they treat the work as a kind of interpretive plaything,
mm-hmm.
and they dig in and come up with something. And they say they had an adventure, they had a little exchange with the work, and here's the results.
So it's sort of like a Rorschach test in a sense then. You want them to sort of look at the work and make a story that is evocative for them,
yes,
inspired by the work?
Absolutely. And there might be kind of psychosocial tensions. There might be... Mm-hmm. You know, a variety of things, but I want them to have a relationship with the thing mm-hmm. in there. And the only way I can know that, or the way it's reflected back, is with a theory they have.
Do you feel like when you're making the work that you have a particular story in mind, or is it just like instincts?
It's instincts. What I try to do is combine elements that have narrative potential
mm-hmm.
so that they could lead in all kinds of ways that seem mm-hmm. fruitful or exciting. It might be just a quality of sexual tension
mm-hmm.
between two characters inside the picture,
mm-hmm.
which you can't really anticipate what's going on. There was a painting in the show with a woman who seemed to be laughing at a much larger guy, or laughing
mm-hmm.
at something he said, or maybe laughing mm-hmm. at him. Her eyes are closed, and so in a way she's in some ways cut off. She's gone into a state mm-hmm. of interiority.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone who comes to it projects some other reading.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mixed race element to it. And so mm-hmm. they might, you know, think about it in terms of.
So you're basically like creating like a play set in a certain way, are you?
I hope so.
But that's so funny. So in a way, like, you're making a story, but you're not thinking like the story has a story. You're thinking of, here's like something, I'm putting something together that people can look at and create their own story. Is
yeah.
that right?
Yes.
That's pretty fucking interesting.
So the story has mm-hmm. a life. So mm-hmm. its life isn't contained.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be properly alive if it just was sealed off into its autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to kind of leak a little bit. I want it to dribble
out.
That's
pretty cool. That's very un-egocentric of you, I think.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's like it's a complicated ego that gets woven into it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of there but not there, or there's a fiction of me that haunts it.
Right. Another thing that I thought of your work, and I read also, was that I think, like, you seem to really have a really, and this is just really natural talent combined with a lot of hours of painting and working, I believe. But you have a real natural or a real facility with drawing and painting and controlling the mediums that you work in. And it feels like when you look at the work that it's exactly like you pretty much are actually probably pretty satisfied with it. Is that true?
I work on them a lot and I edit a lot so that I groom and remove and redo. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, a lot of the elements in the picture I will perform mm-hmm. in character.
What do you mean?
So if for instance, there's a swooping gesture, a paint mm-hmm. gesture that kind of rips across the whole canvas,
mm-hmm.
I kind of have to work myself into a state in which I think, oh, I'm going to be that kind of an artist. I'm acting. And so that the various elements in the picture are like characters that interact with each other. And sometimes they're almost
interesting.
They're like different languages. So if I have, you know, a hard-edged geometric shape
mm-hmm.
that kind of rubs against a smiling somebody,
mm-hmm.
that would be a case of languages or performances interacting with each other.
Right, right. So it's almost like you are an actor learning, like sort of performing I'm trying to say this in that it's almost like you're getting in character as a different artist. It's like you're playing a lot of different roles. Or maybe if you were a musician, you would be playing all the different instruments.
Yeah, absolutely. Or I think...
And you are a musician also. So.
Yes, and I play different instruments. But let's say a writer, if they're writing about somebody loathsome, let's say, it doesn't mean that they are necessarily loathsome, but maybe they found some kind of loathsomeness within themselves where they really want to kind of get at this quality of otherness within the fiction they've crafted.
Well, that's kind of what I was saying about or lines up with what I thought about your ability to control the actual mediums, because it's almost like like that curator, Paul D'Agostino, that we just did the Spring Break project with, he's fluent in 8 languages. So to have, it's almost like you're fluent in a lot of different areas in creating art.
Well, I'm very hungry as an artist. And if I see something in a painting or a work of art that sparks something in me, I want to participate in it. I want to kind of converse with it. I want to make an opportunity for that element to...
So what are your kind of influences?
Well, they're A to Z. I mean, I in some ways kind of grew up out of a sort of Cézanne, Picasso, de Kooning, Gustin tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm, you know, pop art has sort of rolled in because mm-hmm. I feel like popular imagery is just part of the language that I speak, and that but then, you know, Renaissance painting,
so just probably as many influences as
I was
so liberal. What about the story part, like where does that come from? Is that has that been a theme throughout your work? I mean, you've been doing this, you're like my age or something, so you've been doing this since you're like, what, 30, 40 years or something?
Yeah, my first show was in 84. So,
yeah.
And since then, the themes have tended to go in threads or pathways. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain kind of domestic content,
mm-hmm.
like the kind of narratives that happen in intimate personal spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll think about workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does a workplace inflect who a person is, and or how do they intersect with each other,
mm-hmm.
and so that the labor of making a painting is somehow echoed with a different sort of labor inside the fiction, but they're all psychosocial. It's all about mm-hmm. what is it to be a person in a mm-hmm. place among others.
So does that trace back to your childhood?
Well, it would have to, I think.
Well, do you can. Can you see the connection?
Are there some details?
Can you help us out? I mean, are you conscious of the connection? I'm guessing you are, but you don't have to be to make the work. So
I don't know. I feel like I'm not particularly good at tracking kind of specific personal content into what I'm doing now. I guess in some ways I think of myself as a floater, that I don't actually properly exist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not real entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I make fictions,
mm-hmm.
I feel like it thickens the possibility of being real.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. Where did you grow up?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And how many kids in your family?
I have three younger sisters.
And how about your parents? Did they have did they stay together?
They did stay together, and they had a kind of a classic suburban, WASPy sort of nuclear structure.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I was the oldest, and quite a bit older than the youngest one. So mm-hmm. in a way, I was like the kind of vestigial outlier, I was a little bit of the difficult one.
What does difficult mean?
I smoked a lot of weed when I was in high school, and I didn't mm-hmm. do well in school, and kind of nothing came easy.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do?
My dad was in advertising, and my mom.
And as a business person or a creative person?
He was the business person and copywriter. So
yeah,
was,
copy contact, they used to call it in those
Yeah,
days.
He was an English major.
Right.
And he got out of, he went straight into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finished with the Army, he was married my mom. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather said, now it's time for you to think about a career. What do you want to do? He didn't know.
Mm.
Maybe you should take this test. And he took the test in 1954
mm-hmm.
or something. And mm-hmm. The result said, you should go into advertising. And that was it.
So was he like a businessman type guy? I mean, I'm just trying to picture him as all.
No, he was a kind of...
Or was he more of a creative type guy?
He was definitely a kind of social guy. He was not like a business... He was not
Not
hungry.
Super serious?
No, not really. He was warm and kind of sociable. And,
uh-huh.
he was a Sunday sculptor. So there was a creative side to
him. And how about your mom? What did she do?
She
had four kids.
Yeah, she did that. And she uh-huh. she had been a chemistry major in college.
Oh, wow.
And then just left mm-hmm. that behind. And somewhere, maybe when I was in college, she went back to school and became a music therapist and a social worker.
Wow. So what was it like being the oldest boy in a family of four kids? Did it feel like you were... Did it feel like a lot of responsibility, protective? How was that? What did your role feel like?
My role felt like I was exiled to the third floor, and tried to stay away from what seemed to be just mayhem, just screaming, crying mayhem.
You didn't want to get involved in the makeup wars.
No, I didn't. But by the time they were using makeup, I was kind of already gone.
Right.
But the next sister below me was kind of a tormentor.
What's that?
That means that she wanted my attention, and the way she tried to get my attention was by pissing me off.
Ah.
So I found that it was just a war. But what I didn't realize was that it was a war for attention that was underwritten by a kind of desire to connect.
So that's interesting. So you didn't. She actually wanted you to kind of approve of her.
I think so, yeah.
But you interpreted it in a different way because she didn't know how to get what she
right.
expressed that.
She
And when did you clear that up?
I went away to high school.
Oh, you went to boarding school?
I did for 2 years.
Where? Because you took too many drugs and they didn't know what to do with you?
Well, I think they just wanted me out, and I think I was happy to be out.
Mutual.
I went to a Quaker school.
Uh-huh.
And somehow my absence cleared it up with my sister.
Oh, well, that was smart.
Yeah, how about that?
That was good parenting there. And did you actually have a direct conversation where you became to where you came to understand that?
Over the years, it's sort of it's aggregated into a direct conversation. Mm-hmm. You could compress the fragments into something that would look like directness.
How do you think that that influenced your ability or your attitude to relate to women. I mean, first of all, I get the impression for sure that you're very respectful of women. So I don't, that's not part of,
well,
the, but like, do you find them annoying or do you feel like women have, like, I guess what I'm sort of wondering is if you think women have like a little secret community that they're like talking about things that's a foreign language to you. I'm wondering about that.
No, I don't think that. I think my mother was kind of the strong force mm-hmm. in the family. She mm-hmm. was the one who kind of made everything go, and she was, you know, clear, straight up feminist. My sisters mm-hmm. were, you know, they turned into women later. They were girls.
Right, of course.
So I kind of always felt comfortable around women. It's not like it's an alien tribe.
Right. So even though they were arguing and stuff like that, you were fine with your role. You didn't feel left out?
No, I didn't feel left mm-hmm. out. I kind of didn't really want that much to do with it.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, like when you're in grade school, let's say.
Ugh, girls are horrible.
Yeah, I just, you know, I liked playing sports with the boys. And
you had
running.
A lot of guy friends,
had,
right?
Yeah, we had feral friends. And then somewhere mm-hmm. in junior high, suddenly girls start to seem interesting. And mm-hmm.
did you ever
changes.
Have a friend that dated one of your sisters? That would have been likely.
Yes.
That you would, did?
That would be weird. No, yes, that would have been weird.
Never happened.
No, like the when I was a senior in high school, my youngest sister was in the second grade.
Oh.
So she, my...
Well, that wouldn't have been good at all.
That wouldn't have been too good. And then the next one was like in the fourth grade, and the next one was... So they're kind of like out of the picture.
Well, how much younger is your second, the oldest girl?
The oldest one is like 4 grades behind me, three and a half years.
Yeah, that would take a while to catch up. That's true.
Right.
So, because here's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering about, this is like, I'm wondering about, like, there seems like a desire for you to have people make up stories. And I'm wondering where that desire comes from. Like, you want to have, you want to give them all the elements. So you want, but you want them to make the story up. So you're interested in how they're interpreting, how they process things, or there seems like there's a curiosity. I mean, you tell me, I'm not the artist, but
I don't know. I mean,
have you ever thought about that or no?
That's a great question. I haven't really thought about it, but mm-hmm. my first impulse is to think that it's a strange form of sociability. Like, what happens between me cooking up the possibilities of narrative and a spectator who I'm eager to see make narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is that between me and them? That's a kind of a mixture of like a desire for intimacy within the context of no intimacy at all. Like I'm absent completely.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's an interesting charged paradox.
Yeah. Can you explain that a little further? Because I need to try and shut the door here. We've got the door came open. I'm afraid people are hearing music from outside, being that we're in a radio station. But so
do you want me to talk?
Yeah.
As though you're about to answer me, but I'll just keep going until you come back.
No. I'll be right here. I just want to elaborate. It'll take me 2 seconds, but I want you to elaborate on that more because I'm very curious about it, really.
So here's a weird version. I was an art critic for years. I still am sometimes. And I had a book come out that was a compilation of my art writing mm-hmm. called Blind Handshake. So Blind Handshake was the name that I gave to this peculiar social interaction between the artist and the spectator. / critic. So
wait, let me just comprehend that saying again.
The blind handshake is between the artist and the spectator, who presumably never ever see each other.
Ah, got it.
So the spectator is a kind of a fantasy to the artist when they're in the studio.
Right.
And the artist is a fantasy to the person standing before the work because the artist is gone. They're not there.
Right.
And so there, I would wish for a kind of a sociability that occurs on the occasion of the work at the, you know, in this, it's caused by the work. The work is a kind of a strange membrane that that both separates and connects mm-hmm. artists and spectators.
So does it freak you out the way art is paintings, let's say, just to be specific, are consumed, that they are hung up without the artist being around? Does it sort of freak you out a little?
No, I like that. I think that's kind of strange.
So how do you like, I mean, you also played music for a while, right? We were just mentioning sure. you were in a band. So you know what it's like to be on stage and connect in a live, with yes. a live audience.
And that's exciting and very different.
Right. So let's say, would you prefer not to have a live audience?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there was a
you could make, you know what you could do? You could get like a doll set. And then, like, houses, you know, and then, like, give them out and make people do that and see what happened.
Well, I think it is kind of a virtual doll set.
It is a little like that.
Or for boys, it would be soldiers, you
yeah,
know, toy soldiers.
It is a little like that. So do you, are you completely satisfied with just making the doll set and giving it away? Or do you also, are you hungry to have been in the process after you're finished making your doll set painting? Sorry, I don't mean that to sound disparate. That sounds horrible, but you know what I mean.
But what are you picturing in terms of this aftermath?
I'm picturing I'm imagining you being frustrated, and I don't know. I mean, it could just be me projecting. I'm imagining that there's some frustration or otherwise maybe pleasure in being mysterious. This is what I'm imagining, and I'm like, I don't know anything, but I'm imagining that you either want to hear and know how people are interpreting your paintings, or you like the idea maybe you're playing a joke on them by putting all this stuff together and then it's up to them. And I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, do you know what I'm saying, though?
What you're saying. Those are two. I feel like there's some other options, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, neither of those are probably right. But can you explain that?
But the idea of being somehow absent, uh-huh. With a huge amount of intensity, mm-hmm. Appeals to me, and maybe that's mm-hmm. you know, in terms of like your role as a shrink, why would someone ever want that? I have no idea. I do. Uh-huh. I'll do slide talks, let's say, at colleges.
Sure.
I get invited. You show the thing.
Yeah, the guy's got an A-list career. You should check it out, folks. It's like the kind of career. You travel a lot, right? I mean, you're making a living off your work and teaching, for
yes,
sure.
I do shows and do a teaching and all that. But,
yeah, it's
but this
mean.
Thing, this moment of standing before an audience,
uh-huh.
Showing all of your work for 30 years.
Right.
I cannot not apologize at the beginning. I just say, I'm so sorry. Here I am. These works are meant to be seen by you under conditions without me.
Ah.
In conditions of silence in which you can turn your back. You don't have to even look at them. You're free. And now in this room, you're not free. Ah. And these are objects that kind of want to address a person one at a time. You have your own relationship. You can look over here, you can look over there, you can turn your back, look at something else, and return. So when I'm finally there, here's the moment in which I am looking at the audience, they're looking at me, they can ask questions. I apologize. I just say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be here. This is a betrayal of the deep truth.
Wow, that's interesting. I don't think a lot of artists think that way. That wouldn't occur. I mean, it makes a lot of sense what you say, but it wouldn't have occurred to me. So is rejection or acceptance an issue for you? Like whether people like your work or not, is that part of it? Like, is that something that you experience?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I just had a show. I'm ready to kind of, you know, jump off a bridge.
So, I mean, when you're not present with the work, is it easier for you because you're not worrying about the acceptance, rejection aspect?
Yeah, that is
the hot button there? That's a hot button.
Yeah, that is like the most painful and disorienting mm-hmm. part of the whole business. Mm-hmm. Being in the studio, making things, fantasizing about their life out in the world, expecting mm-hmm. The show that's going to open in 6 months or whatever, mm-hmm. that's the juice. Mm-hmm. That's the exciting part.
Mm-hmm.
Scheming and plotting, coming up with a new image, testing mm-hmm. it out, experimenting, mm-hmm. kaboom. Mm-hmm. Here's something amazing.
So is acceptance, rejection, is that something from your childhood? Can we go? Or what do you, I mean, is that true in other areas, or is that just, maybe it's
not. I don't know. You know, that's a good question. No one's ever asked
me. We can come back for that.
Well, I can spin an answer, maybe.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say that, like, just the way you present in the little bit that I know you, which it really is very, very little as far as actually spending time and experiencing you, just like super on the most superficial level of being in your presence, I would say it seems to me as if rejection, I mean, you're neither overly confident or underconfident. To me, you seem very much like that's not something, you don't have a lot of deep insecurity about whether rejection or acceptance. You seem much more healthy and grounded than that.
Well, until I got to art school, I was a pretty substantial underachiever.
Mm-hmm.
Never really got good grades. Might have had a reading disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much like adapted to being mm-hmm. not the special one at all.
Mm-hmm. Were you good at drawing always?
No, I hardly did it.
Huh, it's funny.
I made sculpture, but I had some kind of weird confidence that I could, but uh-huh. just didn't figure out
how. But you weren't an art kid.
I mean, I took classes and I did enough to be... to stand mm-hmm. out and to get into art school. Once I mm-hmm. got into art school, a kind of roadmap was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around and the tribe of artists mm-hmm. That I had never experienced revealed something like this, I'm home.
You learned the history of art a bit, you mean?
Yeah, all of that.
Yeah, which you weren't taken to museums a lot.
I was enough to
but
kind of...
Enough, but not like... You didn't have a real background.
Not an engaged way. It was enough mm-hmm. to kind of think, you know, this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the first thing about how to begin or how to start
right.
or what, how,
right.
to, how to do
So
that.
When you first discovered art, you took to it.
Pretty much. And so I have not stopped for so one second since, like, mm-hmm. you know, freshman year in mm-hmm. college.
So were you... Was that when you discovered that you were good at something? Did that change?
No, I felt like deeply behind. And so I lit the engines of remediation and practiced and worked like a fucking monster forever. I still work very hard. I'm trying to dial it down now, finally.
So you were trying to catch up. You felt
absolutely.
Behind.
I did, absolutely.
And you're still trying to catch up. Are you considered a workaholic?
I was.
Uh-huh.
I'm undertaking the discipline of laziness. I think
yes.
If I can.
You know, I write that as a prescription quite often to people who are workaholic. Discipline yourself to be lazy. Or to do nothing. For some people it is a cognitive thing.
Yeah, and I think maybe these days, I mean, we're all looking for ways to resist
mm-hmm.
The new kind of horrendous order. And you know, I think there is something about indolence. Maybe there's a kind of 19th century, dandy kind of what do you call it, weaponized indolence.
Yeah, like fuck everyone. We're not getting involved in this shit. So not being good at anything and then finding out you could be good at something is part of what's behind that, maybe?
Yeah, that's a little bit of that was kind of a motor. It was an engine for a good mm-hmm. long time.
So how is the show? Do you feel, let me just do the station ID and remind people how happy I am that they're listening to us. I'm here with David Humphrey at Radio Free Brooklyn. Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com. Come to our homepage and donate to Patreon. Like $1 a month would be awesome. How was the show? How was the show emotionally for you?
I love having a show, and I love seeing it all up officially, and I'm very happy that all my friends come, although openings are kind of socially challenging.
Really?
Because,
why?
Because it's nothing but, for 2 hours, a series of interrupted conversations.
Yeah, right, that's true.
With people you care about.
Right, that's true.
So I feel like in the end I've just sort of slighted my 100 closest friends.
Well put. That's funny. I never think of that. I mean, well, not that there's so many. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I could see that.
But then the show's up, and I'm very happy about that. And you know, wish it was up longer. This particular show opened the night before the inauguration.
Oh, man.
Which is to say the
that's tough.
Before the demonstrations.
And, yeah.
And it's felt, and was unseemly to kind of say, hey, everybody,
right.
Think about my show right now, because actually there's other things that are very pressing and very important, and I cared about them too and demonstrated and was glad to.
Other artists that were showing at the time had similar comments. I mean, it makes sense, but yeah, that's part of the deal too. That's tough. But so at the end of the day though, how do you feel now? Let's just do that.
Well, you know, I got a lot of great press.
I just want to be specific about this. It just closed a week ago?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's freshly finished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I like about a show is that my studio is cleared out mm-hmm. in a way those works have been spent, mm-hmm. and I'm free to revisit mm-hmm. new things and develop new ideas. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's the possibility of saying, well, gee, what's the point again?
Why did I do this?
Gosh, there's a lot of David Humphrey paintings and sculpture in the world. Do we really need any more? And
that's
so
pretty funny.
So the only antidote, the only cure for that malaise is to make more.
Right.
Sadly.
So do you feel like you're starting off on a fresh slate, or
yeah.
are you influenced by what the response or having to work up? Will that change your work?
No. I mean, I had some really lovely press.
Yes,
and
you did.
I was happy about the insights and the intelligence brought to it. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But... No, I, almost always though I do feel free to try new things.
Mm.
What does that mean? I mean, I'm always trying new things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just maybe mm-hmm. I have a slightly increased sense of that.
I think I'm going to say this. I think, and then we're going to move on to like how I had a crush on you, but because we promise people, and if you want to call in, if we start talking about it and you have anything you want to say, we're at 718-928-9732. That's 718-928-9732. You're all welcome to call in. Call in and say whatever the fuck you feel like saying. Because I give a shit. So what I'm going to say is that I think that, okay, this is my bullshit psychotherapy conclusion. You tell me if it makes sense. That as kind of a hedge against not feeling like you're good at anything like you used to feel before you started making art, if you work all the time, then at least you're improving, and then you don't have to feel like you're not as good as you could be.
Well, that's a fine kind of Protestant
sort
of version
sense.
Of
no.
it. Yes, no, it makes sense. I guess that's true, and that's quietly there. I find that a little bit embarrassing. I'd rather.
Yeah, that's a problem.
I'd rather be a sort of, you know, anarcho, fuck you, let the chips fall kind of artist. You know, make the executive decision. Like, I'm not going to do anything. How
yeah,
about that?
That's
please, please
what,
love
that,
me.
That's what everybody thinks. And if they don't listen to this, they'll continue to think that and all. But you know, like this is what we're saying. Like art is about we are all exposing ourselves constantly in ways that we don't think we are. So I don't know. There may be some of that in there, maybe not.
Well,
anyway,
here's part of it is that I can sniff this out in certain
mm-hmm.
artists
mm-hmm.
who are working so hard to prove something about themselves,
mm-hmm.
like that they're competent
mm-hmm.
or that they're smart or even that they are, you know, badder, mm-hmm. you know, they're just like a badass.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, if I feel those kind of rhetorical demands, mm-hmm. that neediness,
mm-hmm.
to me, it diminishes the work.
Yeah, I'm not saying that whatsoever. I mean, like I said, I get the feeling that, you know, you've got a really, really balanced ego and that you are not, this is all about you and you. This is not about anything to do with what you want other people to, controlling people. I think your work is very I think your work's incredibly generous. Are you kidding? I mean, you put yourself out there for other people to do whatever happens. And so I'm not insinuating that whatsoever. I think it's really a very internal struggle, which is probably why the work comes out in such a pleasurable, enjoyable. I think the work is really enjoyable, right? It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's smart and thoughtful and deep and complex, but at the end of the day, like, you like it and you enjoy it. It makes you feel good pretty much, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But so I don't think you'd be able to do that if you were, were needy or conflicted.
But there's no doubt that underneath there mm-hmm. has to be. This is just goes with being a person.
Mm-hmm.
Some unresolved dark shit that gets works its way out, mm-hmm. and is maybe even unredeemable bad stuff. Now, it doesn't mean that the work reflects it or has it as manifest content, but the motivation, that sort of the muddy, mm-hmm. undifferentiated kind of gooey sort of stuff that makes up your
mm-hmm. Well,
conditions of yourself.
I'm going to tell you this painting that I made that was hanging at spring break that a lot of people, including Stefan Stux, believe it or not, I finally got to meet him, responded to. And the painting it's a text painting, and it says, as an artist, once the struggle is over, you're fucked. So I think that's an appropriate point here that we all agree on. And to your credit, I mean, you're really, as far as I can tell, very, very successful. And you could stop struggling if you wanted to, but that's obviously something that you're not. You have a lot of integrity about your work, and like that's not part of it, whether you're struggling or not, right?
Yeah, I have to grow.
You have a lot of integrity. There's no doubt about it.
Well, it's that I want to continue to have adventures.
Right.
So, and that means maybe growing, but it means mm-hmm. Becoming disoriented. I have to be able to somehow be off balance to make the new work.
Right. Right. So, interesting. That's interesting. And I want everybody to go to my Facebook page and look at the work. And I think it'll illuminate what we're saying. So here's a chance for me to get some therapy from you, where I can tell you. So I'm going to tell you why what I was projecting on you when I was in my 20s, so in the 80s. So here's the thing. And you tell me if this made sense, because this is like I had made up this story about you. So I was in this relationship with Mike Berg, our mutual friend who is a painter. Next door neighbor. Are you still friends with Mike Berg?
I see him on Facebook, but I've
he
not
lives
seen
in Indonesia now. I looked him up today before the show.
Wow,
is that right?
He was in Turkey. Was the last I heard.
Is it Indonesia, Turkey? Maybe it's Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Yeah. How did he get there? Do you know?
I think he had a friend. Maybe he had an exhibition there. He was charmed and seduced by the city.
Hmm. So anyway, here's the deal. The deal is that we live next door to him. I had this much older boyfriend who I was very shy in those days and very much in the background. And my boyfriend, who's also named David, was extremely funny and outgoing and socially aggressive and 13 years older and made a really good amount of money. And we lived in this like fabulous loft where I was making like no money as a junior beginning baby art director in advertising, and David was sort of like a creative director or whatever, so I was always in this role of being in a very passive role without having any kind of say over things, because like he would just decide he wanted to get a TV and he'd go out and buy one. It would never be our thing. It would always be his. So that was me in my 20s until I like got fed up of that. And here I am today, nothing like that, but well, not quite. But what I was really missing in those days was somebody who was like committed to me and respected me. And I think that you seemed, well, you are a good looking guy, right? I mean, you probably knew that. Did you know that? No, no, he's my.
I had massive pimples. I walk around. I still think I'm kind of a monster.
Okay. Well, I'm sure. Yeah. Okay. So maybe, I don't know if you were conscious of it or not, but I mean, also another thing about looks is that my boyfriend David that I live with, and my husband is so aware of this. We always laugh about it. was 5'6", like an inch taller than me. And it always bothered me how short he was. You're like 6 foot something, or 6 foot?
Three,
yeah. So is my husband. So like when I broke up with David, I said, no matter what, I'm changing that. The next guy has, I wouldn't date anybody who was under 5'10 after I broke up with him. So you were tall, that, but also you seem very, like you would be really respectful of the woman you were with. Was that a good, accurate kind of thing? And you seemed like, yeah, maybe it was that you didn't seem desperate for attention or something like that. Is that accurate?
Probably. I think that's accurate. Yeah. In some ways, I feel like I missed out on the sort of the roving kind of relationship adventurer. I tended to be with one person.
Yeah, maybe that's what I was like. And I think, and you were with. I remember you had a girlfriend. I mean, this was all just like all in my head anyway. So you had a girlfriend or a wife when, and you had a kid. Dear listeners, so I was saying this to David before you guys heard, before we started, but I was saying that I used to see him. And you know what? If I was a stalker, I would have stalked him, but I don't know how to do that very well. I'm too shy. So, but I used to see him with a baby in a baby carriage, and I used to think, oh, look how, you know, great this guy has this great relationship. I'll never have a really solid relationship, blah, blah, blah. So tell me about that. What was your life like in those days?
Well, I was a total Mr. Mom, and my ex and I were both artists, and so mm-hmm. we just took parenting, the number of parenting hours, and divided them in half.
Mm.
So I would... I was that guy at the playground.
That must have been it.
The only guy at the playground.
Oh, that must have been
There's
it.
There's like the nannies over there and the moms over there.
Oh, that must have been it.
So I did that. And that was cool because it meant I got to, you know, really know my daughter well.
Yeah.
And I guess, but I did not take advantage of, and I was not even aware that there is this thing of like the lone dad with their kid as a chick magnet.
Oh, you could have had the ladies. Are you kidding?
I was such an idiot.
Why didn't you? Maybe you weren't even aware of it. Maybe that's what I found appealing about you.
I didn't know how to navigate across that space.
So how did you meet your wife? Like, what was that like? How old were you guys?
First wife?
Yeah, the first wife.
She was a couple years older than me. I was an undergrad. And
where?
I was at the New York Studio School.
I went to classic lit training.
Yeah, I went to MICA, and I decided to do my junior year at the New York Studio School.
Mm-hmm.
I did one semester, and then the second semester, she came, and she had been there before and had graduated, and she was using it as a kind of grad school, and she seemed very kind of confident and authoritative and attractive, and so I was very glad that somehow she gave me the time of day, and the next thing you know, I'm kind of in a way, meshed. Mm-hmm. We're living together, and then a kid comes along, and so whether we should have stayed together or not.
So you were interested in her first.
I was kind of vaguely interested in everybody.
Ah.
I was like a hungry, voracious young guy.
Right.
And she so in a way she emerged with like real serious. Kind of intentions with regards to
me. Did she like sort of take the initiative? You were available, but did she?
We sort of fell into something, and then she took the initiative in the direction of like solidifying it.
You mean getting married?
Yeah, first living together, then
like girls do.
Yeah, right. I got caught into a spider web.
You got caught up with that's what these chicks do, you know. So you were married to her for 20 years?
Like 18. We were together for 18.
And you're
like
with your current wife for like...
about 20.
Yeah, for longer, right.
So there it is. There's the pattern.
So you had a child with your first wife.
Yes.
And was that planned? Was it planned?
Planned.
Did you use a condom? That's what I'm asking. I'm just basically asking you, did you use a condom?
planned by her. I did not. I thought back then it was this rumor that if you smoke a lot of weed, it lowers your sperm count.
Yeah, well, that's probably
That didn't work.
If you're 50, maybe. So you mean you guys got pregnant by surprise?
I think she was interested in that happening. And
she hooked you into getting pregnant.
She did, more or less.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you think that?
Well, I knew that this was in the mix.
So it was a little unplanned. So it just devil may care. This is what happened. So how?
Yeah, I thought, you know, I'm a capable person, and having a kid was something it could handle, and maybe it wasn't on the top of my list, but there it was.
So you were married for 20 years, so things must have been pretty decent most of that. That's a successful relationship,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
Are you still friends with your ex-wife?
Yeah, more or less.
Mm-hmm. And your daughter is 30, and
she's just got married. She's a shrink, and she just got married herself.
Oh, really? That's so nice.
It's sweet, yeah. And
she married an artist?
She married a designer, artist, musician.
Oh, nice.
Totally cool guy.
Where does she live?
Brooklyn.
Oh, nice. So you're close to her?
Yes.
That's great.
We play tennis every week.
Oh, lovely. And how about your current wife? Did she ever want to have children?
Well, she and I were so instantly compatible. We so just lit up we caused the sun to rise every day. It was a total mad,
wow,
beautiful thing.
Wow.
And it turns out she is a very impressive writer. I didn't know at the time she's a musician also,
mm-hmm,
and a painter.
Wow.
So it turns out we just shared everything.
Mm.
We shared all our kind of ambitions. And so we turned out to be a kind of a collaborative entity, both with a band, and we make exhibitions together.
Oh, so you guys have played music together as well?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. Do you make art together? I mean, I've seen her art, which is up right now at Freight and Volume, just open. We'll be up for another month. And the one downtown, the one on Lower East Side.
Yes. We had a show. She and I had a show of collaborations up at the gallery called Arts and Leisure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's way uptown,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a satellite of
Freight
and Volume.
Oh, really?
And we have another show in April in Lincoln, Nebraska, of our collaborations.
Oh, wow. So how are your collaborations different than than each of yours work? Or how do you guys work when you collaborate?
It is by nature more schizo. I mean, they're they're kind of slightly more insane.
But what's the technique? What's the process of how you work together? Do you just take out a big canvas and you each get a brush? And
yes, usually
is it really like that?
It's usually one at a time. We pass them back and forth.
Oh.
And the trick is to kind of amuse or kind of throw off balance what the other person has done.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it's a kind of coherent painting, as though one kind of slightly fucked up person made it.
How do you know? I guess it's kind of an unspoken thing, right? You have sense. You just kind of have a sense of where it's going and when it's done and all that. Do you argue about it, or do you have conflict about it?
Yeah, we have mild differences, but usually it resolves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Jennifer tends to want to kind of polish them slightly more than I do. I kind of want to play out a sort of casual kind of throwaway feeling where she'll kind of want to put little twinkles on the eyes of the characters inside the painting.
So do you just kind of like take the painting at a certain point and hide it from her or something?
That's impossible. She'll find it out. She'll root it out.
Well, that sounds real. See, I was right. You probably do have your shit together enough to have a decent relationship, because to me, I think that's one of the hardest things. I mean, my husband is also an artist. Our work is really, really different, but you know, we definitely have conflicts about that just because we're very different in the way that we work.
Well, I think I have a high tolerance for volatility.
I
don't know what your thing is, but are you the volatile one? I mean, do you freak out?
Well, he would say so. No, I mean, like, for example, like, we just both did spring break, and, like, I like to have everything organized and all set up, and, you know, Phil likes to make, like, something, like, huge and work it out on the site, and part of the process is, like, the tension, and to me, it just seems so stressful.
Right.
So we're just both, like, the way he works makes me insane. So I just, I mean, we did pretty well because we were able to both be very productive and completely separately without getting in each other's way. Hardly at all, which was an achievement. But as far as...
That's craft. That's like a collaborative craft situation where you can... I mean, I'm kind of assuming you made this piece was the two of you?
No. Because I did my work, which was paintings and mirrors, text pieces, and the therapy office. And he had these three huge installations each one is a photograph of like places that there was conflict in America recently, you know, like Ferguson or something like that.
Sure. So
they're just really unrelated. Our work is pretty much unrelated. But so what I'm saying is, like, part of our problem is, like, we can't work. It's hard for us to work together because the methods that we create are so different.
Yeah, I guess in our case, sometimes it'll be a case in which, I said case twice there, didn't I? Here's a piece of shit beginning. Please fix it, honey.
Oh, really? And is that what she says? Or is that what it is like?
That's what she says. And I say it, too.
Like, uh-huh. That's funny. That's kind of cool, though.
Yeah, I think it.
And then, are you pretty much happy when the paintings are done? Are you in agreement?
Yeah.
And do you like the same ones? Do you feel the same way about why ones are successful and not successful?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. Okay, we have 3 minutes left, and as a stepmother myself, who I love my stepson so much, Christopher. But I just want to hear about. Can you describe how Jennifer? How old was she when you? How old was your daughter when you started dating Jennifer?
My daughter was 10 or 11.
So how was that? How is Jennifer? How is integrating Jennifer as a stepmother? And that's me as a stepmother.
So that's,
curious.
So that's a challenging, definitely challenging question, and she would probably answer it differently than I did. But it was not easy because when you split up, when I split up with Simone's mom. There's a kind of, you know, I was there continuously as a parent, but it opens the door for the possibility that dad could go away. If dad is breaking up with mom, why couldn't dad break up with me?
Mm-hmm.
I think
in
the child's unconscious. So what happens is, you know, it's a slightly more kind of charged attachment mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. happens that makes it hard for a new relationship, like with Jennifer and I.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to navigate through that, and it was mm-hmm. Ups and downs, and those two had to work it out, and I had to kind of let smoke blow out of my ears when the girl kind of tension builds excruciatingly in a tiny apartment in the West Village.
Oh my God, yeah, because I mean for me in a way it was easier because Christopher and Phil, they would go off and do their guy things, they didn't want me around. But you had two ladies. Yeah, that could be stressful, but it's probably paid off, right?
It has totally paid off.
Are they really good
yes,
friends now?
They are.
And it's, yeah,
and,
it's great,
and now
right?
Jennifer has been a kind of a major presence in Simone's life, actually. He's been in her life for more than she hasn't been in her life.
Right. But it does take, that's not easy for anybody, is it?
Definitely not easy, and there's no guidebook.
Yeah,
because
there's
it's
no
so
guide,
on the fly. Things happen. They just erupt unexpectedly. You stepped on a mine. Oops. Somebody's feelings are hurt.
So here's a shout out to all the stepmothers out here because we're going to have to say goodbye being that the show is over. And thanks so much for listening in. And you should stay and listen to the mixtape show that's right on after this one by Elan. It is so funny. It's like all these different mixtapes. And he's a really terrific host on Radio Free Brooklyn at www.radio, that's RADIO, free, FRE. Dr. Lisa gives a shit.